Okay. Welcome, folks, to this session. They usually put me late in the week. After you're tired and, you know, you've seen all the code you can stand. Because this session is not about code. There's not a line of code in it. And so, for those of you who expect that at every Tech Ed session, let me tell you that up front. No, this is about user experiences. This is about the problems that developers face going into the modern world and how to deal with it. Some suggestions for how to adapt to the way things are now. And I mean the way things are, not the way we might wish them to be in many respects. Look, this is what I like to use to set the stage. This was the banner placed at the entrance to the Anaheim Convention Center last September for the Build Conference. Please notice that tagline. Use what you know, do what you've always imagined. Does that strike you as an odd thing for a Microsoft conference to be promoting? Because this, you know, imagination is what we associate with those other guys, Apple and people like that. But Microsoft now understands that we're in a different world, that we're playing a different game now. They're up against tough competition. They're going into the consumer space. And because the consumer space has become so different in the last few years, we are seeing the leakage of that into the business space. We're seeing workers that come up with their whole experience around technology being iPods and iPads and Android tablets and other kinds of touch devices, and they expect better in corporate software than we've traditionally given them in the past. This reminds me, in a certain extent, of a previous era that I lived through early in my own career. In 1985, IBM ran the world. They were dominant in mainframes, mini computers, micros, biggest software company in the world. They were biggest everything. And then the system in which they operated, our ecosystem of technology, started going through massive radical change. We got PCs and distributed computing. We got local area networks that later gave rise to the internet as machines all over the world were connected. We got graphical user interfaces, a completely different way for the user to interact with the computer. Well, to me, the present has some similarities to that. We're seeing a wide proliferation of devices. I said proliferation right the first time. I stumble on that about every third time. Touch computing is becoming pretty much ubiquitous. We are expecting to see ubiquitous connectivity too. We expect to talk to the net no matter where we are. We're getting accustomed to applications that use cloud computing as their storage mechanism. We're starting to see devices that don't look or act anything like the devices we've been accustomed to throughout our career. The iPad, the Kindle Android tablet, the Windows smartphone, all of those are changing the conditions of things. Now, the way I like to put it, my short version, is this. As long as you've been in this business, it's been good enough to add functionality, just to create some functionality that wasn't there before. That's all you've needed. And my first message to you is, you're not in that world anymore. It's no longer enough to make things possible. Now, your success, the success of your company too, also depends on making things easy. And this is pretty tough. See, we have a lot of habits. You know how they talk about, I don't know if you've heard this story, that zoo people talk about this, when they change habitats. That if an animal was in a cage for a long period of time, and they remove the cage, the animal has a tendency to walk around the boundaries of the cage that's no longer there. Well, I see developers doing that too. Because of the technologies that they've been using, this is what they're accustomed to producing. It doesn't much matter what it is. We think of the screen as a bunch of rectangles, and we pour something into every rectangle. Well, the problem is that the technologies have gone past us. With modern technologies like HTML5 and XAML, we're not restricted to this, but we still pace around inside our invisible cage. So what I'm telling you now is it's common knowledge in this industry that it's time to get beyond this. But it is hard because of the habits you've formed for an entire career, that invisible cage you live in. You need to break out, and I want to help you do it. But for some of you, that is particularly hard. because it means breaking an addiction that you have. I'm estimating a third to a half of you have this addiction. You want to write code. That's what you're in this business to do. You know, because there's another meaning of the word habit. And there are people in this industry that really don't want to do anything else. That's okay if you want. You probably think, gosh, I'm really good at it. I don't have to worry too much. You know what? That's what the COBOL guys back in the 1980s thought too. Where are they today? Look, they were smart guys. They wrote the software your checks are probably processed through today. They ran the world in the 1980s. 10 years later, they were reduced to patching up systems for Y2K. And 5 years after that, they were out of work. So I assume that you want to go forward and adapt to the changes upon us. Now, because of the addiction, because of the fact that you are kind of trapped in this cage, one of the most common mistakes that people make is think that better design, better user experience, primarily means better aesthetics. That you get cosmetics and you're fine. Well, now, aesthetics do matter. It's not that aesthetics are meaningless. There's a reason they don't put ugly people on magazine covers. Okay, they know that if they did, they wouldn't sell very many of them. In fact, they don't just put pretty people on there. They even, I'm going to have to get away from the speaker here. He doesn't like me. Let's get back. I apologize to you folks right here. I was going to come and talk to you for a minute, but the speaker doesn't want me to, so I have to go back over there. Is that all right? Okay. They don't only put pretty people on there. Do you notice the woman in the upper left, second from the left there? I don't think her waist is really that small. Do you? I'm pretty sure it's not. So I understand why they do this. And it is important to understand that aesthetics do help us. People form first impressions in a matter of seconds. So aesthetics do matter. You want the first impressions to be good. You want people to believe at first glance that your software is high quality, something that they'd like to use. The problem is that aesthetics will only carry you so far. Aesthetics will not make up for just badly designed software in every other respect. Here's a counterexample. Some of you may have seen this. Conexant Smart Audio, do any of you have ThinkPads with this software on there? Nobody? Well, that's good, actually. Let me show it to you for just a moment. I've got it up. Oh, no, I didn't bring it up, did I? Let me go to my control panel and bring it up for you. Because this software is absolutely gorgeous. It has fabulous cosmetics. Here it is. And it's absolutely incomprehensible. Here we go. Okay, classic and multi-stream. What does that mean? Oh, gosh, I don't know. And what about these buttons? Red? What do these do? What does that mean? What are they doing? I have no idea. But boy, the cosmetics are nice, aren't they? Isn't this beautiful software? Now, how about if I switch to classic? Oh, gosh, it sits there and thinks. And thanks. And thanks. I have no idea what it's doing. And it finally comes back. What has it changed? Oh, I guess maybe something about where the stuff is coming out. But what is this? I don't know what any of this means. If I go to, what was it, this thing here? No, it was this one, I think. What does it mean to select different? I don't know what any of this means. You probably think that's the way you minimize the application right there. No, no, that's a menu. It's just in a really stupid place. So this is an example of software that gets all the cosmetics right, but gets everything else wrong. And as a consequence, I don't care that the cosmetics are nice. I loathe that software. I detest it. I uninstalled it from my machine as soon as I found out about it. I reinstalled it yesterday just to show to you. It will be uninstalled later this afternoon. Here's another example. This looks pretty nice, doesn't it? As long as you like orange as a color. I went to the University of Tennessee at Knoxville. Got burned out on orange as a young man, so I don't like it much. But the cosmetics, the arrangement's good. The layout's not bad. The topography's good. And yet, I'm a customer of this company. And every time I use this software, I go into a screaming rage because it's so hard to use. We got any other AT&T users in here who know about this? Doesn't this website suck toxic waste? It's just awful. They got the cosmetics right, and that's not enough. So if you think you can just delegate over to somebody to somehow magically make your software better. Well, even in the best case, you'll end up with something that's not any better than what you have now. This is a WPF program, but it looks like a Windows Forms design with a few colors applied to it. Look, that just doesn't help your software. You can put the cosmetics on there. If it's a pig, it's just a pig with makeup on. So that's the most common mistake that people make. They make it because developers want to keep snorting the code, and they want to delegate the responsibility of making the software better and easier to use, et cetera, better designed. They want to delegate that to someone else. And my first message to you is, you can't. Not in the typical company. There isn't someone who knows how to do it. There are people around who know how to make it pretty. There are graphics designers, and there are people who have experience making content pretty, and they understand layout and such, but they don't understand interaction design. We'll take that subject up a little bit later. So I'm telling you the responsibility is there, and I'm telling you that in order to meet it, you'll have to get outside the ruts that you've been in most of your life. Now, again, some of you are probably thinking, I don't know, gosh, I'd just like to stay in those ruts. How bad could it be? I live in Nashville, Tennessee. You know what we do there? A lot of music stuff, studios, country music, not just country music. A guy that was in Fleetwood Mac lives in Nashville. You may have saw last week, he put a gun to his head and committed suicide. It has nothing to do with living in Nashville, by the way. He had some medical problems. From 1940s up through 1990s, early 2000s, big companies dominated the music business. They understood how to sell CDs. Again, smart people, they were tapped into all of the revenue streams from music. And it resulted in ridiculous sums of money coming through Nashville because of the music business. And everybody in the music business was dependent on them. But then their system got totally disrupted. This changed the music industry beyond belief. And this is what Music Row in Nashville looks like today. I took all these signs within less than 100 yards of each other, and I could have taken a dozen more if I'd wanted to. So there's the warning. These things that are coming along are changing our developer system, and we have to adapt to them. And the changes aren't even done. Yeah, sure, we got touch computing. What's this device going to do to our developer system? What are we going to do to use it for business applications? I don't know. I'm sure at some point it'll probably be able to do the equivalent of, you look stressed, Dave, why don't you take a stress pill? Something like that. But how are we going to interact with that? I don't know. But we have to break out of that. We have to break our own habits. We live in this invisible cage based on the stuff that we've always done, and we need to get past that. So, this is where you are kind of today, doing stuff like this. And that means that you end up doing screens that end up looking like this. This is the typical sort of screen that when I go into a client site to see what they're doing, I mean, I've spoofed this up fairly clearly. If you read some of the labels, you'll see that it's all made up. But this, at first glance, is the general feel I get. How many of you have screens that viscerally kind of look pretty much like this? Okay, we're going to get to the reason for why you have that and why you should avoid it a little bit later. Let's talk a little bit about where you need to be. What does software look like now that's different from that? Oh gosh, well, it started a few years ago with things like this. All right, look at this experience. I go to settings, things flow in. I go there, and things flow back. We're not just dividing up into rectangles. We're getting nice effects, easy feedback so the user can see what they want to do. Well, that's pretty nice. And then we move up to things like this. Whoops. Anybody, any of you have Zune? Zune's pretty nice software. Look at the experience here. Look at the ability for people to just kind of naturally resonate to this and understand how it works. Well, you think, gosh, yeah, but that's entertainment software, Billy. It's business software. Well, as I said, we're starting to see the blending and the merging of those. So your understanding of what things used to be like, that separation between consumer and business, is starting to go away. Windows 8 as an operating system isn't aimed at you. It's aimed at consumers. It's aimed at a completely different set of people. So you need to make business software do this stuff too. And my machine here has gone to sleep, so I'll have to wake it up very quickly and show you one piece of business software. Some of you may have seen this before. Piece of software my team and I wrote about 3 or 4 years ago. And I forgot to bring the power adapter. I've got about 6 hours of power, but I forgot to bring the power adapter, so it went to sleep on me. Give it a moment or two, it'll wake up. You are going to wake up, aren't you? Yeah. That's where I was playing the slides earlier. Let's take a look at this software. Some of you may have seen this. This is business software. But notice what it has in common with some of that consumer software you saw a few moments ago. It's a real app, by the way, so I do have to actually get the password right and all that. And I had to change it a few minutes ago because it told me it was expiring. So we can move around, we can do drill down, and we go back and forth. We can get down to, well, it's doing some asynchronous loading of the work items that people need to see. I guess because it's just coming back from sleep, that's a little bit slow. If we click on something, we go all the way down to the individual tab that somebody, that we need to change things. We can go and see a Google-ish kind of searching, and we can see organizational charts of our customers with their main office and their child offices. We can have an editing experience that looks like this. Where we can shrink the foreground back and gray it out while we're concentrating on the new child screen. See that again. We can put expandable elements that people can only use when they need to. We can do that over here too. If we notice that, oops, it didn't have a picture. Let's go back to the other one. Anna's got a picture. We can look at Anna. We can make things interactive in ways like that. So we have the ability to make software that looks and acts a whole lot like consumer-based stuff. Now, what's the point? Well, because that kind of software, if it's properly designed, is more intuitive and more productive. The software you just saw replaced a package and cut training time by over 80%. And it boosted productivity by some measurable metrics by 20 or 30%, I think was the last time we measured, in terms of the amount of stuff that users were able to do while they were logged in, the orders they were able to complete to place workers with companies and such. So that's where we'd like to be as developers. But the question then, of course, is how to get there. And that's what I'd like to spend the balance of this session on. So that's where you need to be. And the first step to getting there is understanding some underlying design principles. I did a session about this last year, and I'm going to look at a few different principles than I did last year. How many people were in the session last year on design principles? Yeah, you'll see a couple of screens that you've seen before, but I'm mostly new design principles. So if you saw the stuff last year, I'm doing different things this time. I am expanding one thing, though, because I want to talk about, particularly in this section, design principles that go against the habits of your career. So one of the habits that you have, I bet you've heard this one a lot, screen real estate is valuable. You heard that phrase? In your design sessions, that's why everybody wants to cram everything possible. They don't want to leave any empty space on there at all. Why is that? Why do they say that? Look, pixels are free. You can make as many of them as you want. If you've got under certain circumstances, you can even go to a navigation pattern that will allow you to do things like this. We can have a viewport here so we can, you know, scroll around and show the different things. That's the kinds of things that our modern technologies allow us to do. So pixels are pretty much can be manufactured at will. Why do we talk about screen real estate being valuable? In the modern world, that's not really true. That comes out of a mentality of habits from going all the way back to character-based software when we really did have 24 lines and 80 columns, and those spaces were all we had. And then we translated that up to pixels, at first 640 by 480 and then 800 by 600, but we got in this mental habit of thinking of the screen as being fixed. And moving things around on it is not part of our normal experience. But for modern user experiences on consumer type software, that's the norm. That's the way things work there. So we have to break some old habits. But is it really bad to have crowded screens? You probably have people who think it's a great idea. You probably have users who claim that they like it. Well, I would tell you that they claim that they like it because they've never seen anything better. That psychologically, in fact, they don't like it, and I can prove it to you. There's a design principle called horror vacui. It's fancy Latin, just means fear of empty spaces. Let me do a test for you. I want to show you two shop windows. By the way, if you were here last year, these are different shop windows. I'm going on a field trip, I'm going to show you some more stuff, okay? Two shop windows. I want to show each one for about 3 seconds. I want you to decide, based just on first impressions now, which one of these you think is selling expensive goods and which one you think is selling cheap goods. You ready? You ready to look now? Okay. Okay, so which one of those was selling cheap goods? The second one. We know that. Based on what? Psychologically, the fact that it was crowded had the psychology that told us that it was cheap. There is a psychological connection there. Look, I went to the Mall of America. That's where I took those pictures. I went specifically to shoot shop windows. That's why I went down there. I was doing a client engagement in Minneapolis. Minneapolis is one of the retail capitals of the world. Target, Dayton Hudson is headquartered there. Best Buy is headquartered there. Mall of America, I think, is still the biggest mall in the United States. These people know retail, and this is what I saw. I started walking through the mall looking for crowded shop windows, and boy, did I have a hard time finding them. I had to get all the way to the third floor before I found one. The Lego store has this wide open empty shop window. Now look, these people wouldn't be doing that if they didn't have a good reason. They understand the psychology of their customers, of the buyers who are likely to come into their store, and what they're saying to them is, yeah, we're a very high-quality place. Just this is an idea of what you would see in here, so why don't you come in and look for some more? I got to one point, even the mannequins were saying, no, leave it empty, please. Nothing else in here. So they understand. I had to go all the way to the third floor to get to this. Now, maybe these people are doing the right thing. They're communicating to you the idea their stuff is cheap, inexpensive. You know, we're just selling t-shirts, man, they're cheap. Come on and buy one, just to be a few bucks. Well, that's fine for them. Maybe it's the right thing to do. But your users aren't paying for your software. They're not making a cost-benefit decision about using it. So don't you want it to have the psychological connotation of being high quality and expensive instead of cheap? When you go to crowded screens, the psychological effect you're putting in their mind is this software is cheap because we didn't take the time to figure out how to make it work well. We just dumped it all on the screen because we're too lazy to figure out what you really need to see and when you need to see it. And the fact that we've been doing it a long time doesn't change the fact that if you can design the software properly, they prefer this. We know this from the times that we've taken some of our software packages in and showed them to users. Now, certainly, you are in certain situations, you do need to pack everything in. Okay? I grant that there are such circumstances. But you better be aware of the implications and understand that you do that when you have users that are capable, number one, of handling high cognitive load. Okay, that's a delicate way of putting it. How many of your users do you think can handle high cognitive load? Okay, if you're a space shuttle pilot, sure, you can memorize all this stuff, you can figure it out. We also expect, if we're going to do this, that we're going to need more training time, dramatically more training time than we would otherwise. And you tend to think this sort of thing is okay because you work with the equivalent in the software world every day. You think that because Visual Studio packs everything in, that it's not so bad, but you are not your user. You are capable, in most cases, of handling higher cognitive load than they can. So you need to put yourself in their mind and understand what they need. So that's horror vacui. That's one design principle. Let's talk about another set of design principles. This has to do with how the human brain is wired, how the visual system is wired, and how it works. These principles go back to some research done by German scientists in the 1920s on how the human visual system worked, and because the Germans were doing the work, they got to name it. They're called the Gestalt principles. Gestalt meaning form, shape, structure, something like that in English. Studying how the human eye works got us to several principles of design that are in this family of Gestalt principles. So let's go through some of them and understand how they work. I'm going to show you two slides. I want you to tell me, let me show you one first. I'm going to show you an array of four-pointed stars. And I want you to tell me, do you see rows of stars or columns of stars? Ready? What do you see? You see rows. You see rows only because of proximity. The stars in a row are closer together than the other stars. And we can prove it by changing to this, do you see rows or columns now? You see columns, and notice that that's the same size array of stars. All we've done is change the spacing. The eye naturally assumes that things that are close together are related. Now, what does this mean for software development? Well, you see foolishness like this from people who don't understand this principle. This is spoofed up from a website where they were ordering hamburgers of some kind. I think the intent was, with radio buttons, let's force them to choose every one instead of using checkboxes. So let's force them to choose. But when you first look at this, how many groups of radio buttons do you think there are? You think there are two because of the spacing of the columns of radio buttons. No, there are actually six pairs of radio buttons. We're going to talk about how to fix this later. I've got another slide later. So that's the Gestalt principle of proximity. But it turns out that there are other Gestalt principles too. We can actually override what the eye sees in terms of grouping with other techniques. For example, let's look at this. Do you see rows or do you see columns? You see rows this time? Why? It's exactly the same as this one, except I put color on some of them. See that? You see rows, you see columns. So it turns out that there are several principles that can override proximity, particularly similarity. Similar objects are unconsciously grouped together. There are various attributes that you can use for that. Color is only one of them. We can also see, there's color. We can also use shape to do grouping. Even size can be used for grouping. Again, we see rows instead of columns because of the commonly sized objects. And in fact, shape is so powerful that it will cause us to see a group even when things are scattered around like this. Now, you've actually seen the Gestalt principle in use in various places. Data visualization people figured this stuff out a long time ago. Here, the Gestalt principle of proximity is used for each time period. You know that the items in quarter one are grouped by time because of their proximity. On the other hand, you'd also like to be able to follow category over a span of time. So the Gestalt principle of similarity using color is used to do that. And if you know Gestalt principles of proximity and similarity, you can use them to make things stand out. If I told you, find the triangle, how long does it take? It's virtually instantaneous. Same thing, find the star that's not the same color as the others. Your eyes are tuned. It requires very little cognitive effort to do things that properly respect the Gestalt principles. because the processing for the Gestalt principles are actually done at a lower level than conscious thought. The initial impressions come out of the way the visual system is wired. Another Gestalt principle, continuity and closure. The visual system has a tendency to automatically fill in gaps. That's because way back in our past, we needed to recognize threats very quickly. If we saw this and we waited to make sure that we saw the entire leopard, we'd probably be the leopard's lunch. So our visual system tries to do better than that. You see a rectangle here. There's no rectangle there, but your visual system sees it instead. This is one of my favorites. There's nothing there but triangles with one rounded side. But you see the ball. You can't help it. We're starting to see that in use in a lot of modern systems. If you analyze the icons in Windows 8, for example, they're very minimalist. They let you fill in the gaps. We went for a while to very realistic icons as our video systems got better. And now we're seeing a tendency to go back and do very good design based on filling things in. Look at that camera down in the lower right-hand corner. That's not much of a drawing of a camera, but it's enough that we don't have any trouble quickly recognizing it because our eye fills in the gaps for it. So modern iconography is based on that principle. Another Gestalt principle is figure and ground. Your visual system decides what to pay attention to and what not. The part that it considers the foreground, the part that's going to get the attention, is the figure. The rest is just kind of screened out. It's the background. And it's unconsciously given lesser importance. Some of you may have seen diagrams that look like this. What do you see when you look at that? Two faces? What else? Vase? Let's do the percentages. Who saw two faces at first? And who saw a vase? Who saw a vase? See, that's pretty typical. The vase tends to be a little bit lesser. But which one you see depends upon what do you sort of unconsciously decide is the figure and which is the ground based on your experience in the past. That means and of course, you can go back and forth, can't you? Now that I've told you this, you can go, oh yeah, I see the vase now, or I see the faces that I didn't see before. To some degree, once you take conscious control, then it can be shifted. And that ability to shift figure and ground has a place in software design. The figure can change into the ground and vice versa, and that's most commonly used to maintain context. So for example, you saw this a few minutes ago. I had an editing screen from my software, and then I pressed an edit button. The main screen shrank back and grayed out to get this. What that does is unconsciously tell the user what you were looking at before, which was the foreground, the figure, has now been shifted to become the ground. You don't need to pay as much attention to it. We now have a new figure, a new foreground that we want you to pay attention to. And then, of course, when it's done, you can put it back. It turns out that a common background, can also be used for grouping. So this would be one way to deal with that horrifically designed screen we saw a few moments ago. First of all, we'd like to get away from some of that proximity problem, not respecting the Gestalt principle of proximity, but what we'd also like to do is give some even more obvious groupings. Now, there's a tendency to group things the habit in most developers is when you have to group things like this, you put them inside of some rectangular figure, you draw lines around them. But there's a reason you don't want to do that. There's another design principle called contour bias that I don't have time to go into today. People prefer curved things, so having a gentle curved background like this accomplishes the purpose, but feels better to the user, feels more natural. You can see some of these principles in use. There's one of those Zoom screens. Notice the things down in the lower left. There's nothing showing them as being related except that they're kind of the same size. They're all exactly the same height. And your eye picks up on that. The icons under the welcome screen all have a certain shape similarity and size similarity. They don't have to group them with some kind of a box. the pictures and the albums that come on there, they're rectangular because the covers and the pictures are rectangular. But again, they're grouped by proximity. They're not even necessarily the same size. So if we understand some of these principles, we can go back and look at software and understand how they accomplished some of the things that they did, if we understand the design principles involved. If you're doing drill down, for example, you're doing hierarchical drill down. Now, this is pretty garish because I wanted to make it really obvious when I put it on the screen, but it's very easy to see that one level in the hierarchy is a completely different kind of record than the other level. So when I drill down, the visual system obviously parses out that the second layer is a set of courses that are associated with a particular department. The departments look the same, the courses look the same, but they don't look like each other. If they were all the same size and had the same general layout, it would be much more difficult cognitively for the user to zero in on the group and understand where he was in the hierarchy and what he or she was doing. So that's the Gestalt family of principles. Man, there are lots of principles. Let's look at another one. This is a control in a vehicle. I think it's a BMW. I'm not positive. What do you suppose that set of controls right there do? It operates the seats. How do you know that? There's no labels. It looks like a seat. Man, it maps onto what people think a seat should look like. That's the design principle of mapping. When you can make something correspond to something in the real world, you're much better off. For example, what part does that control? That's the part where you sit, and it doesn't take any extra effort for somebody to figure that out. We see this sometimes in software such as here. Did you ever think about why they did it this way? This is pretty easy to use. You kind of drag the things around, because it's supposed to map what your actual physical monitor situation looks like. So if you have software that corresponds to anything in the real world, then you need to use the mapping principle to make it apply. But even some things are just concepts, like up and down buttons. If you're going to raise something or lower something, should the buttons be above one another or side by side? See, up and down maps to up and down. So cognitively, that's much easier for people to parse. Let's show you. Let's do another design principle test. You like the test? Are they fun? Okay, here's your test. I'm going to show you three screens. Each screen has a different colored background, so that you can tell when the screen shifts. And each screen has a variety of tools that you would have around the house. Just drawings of them. They're not actually pictures, just drawings of tools. And your job is to tell me at the end, I'm going to show you each one only about 4 seconds, and your job is to tell me at the end how many of those screens have a pair of scissors on them. Okay? You ready? Okay, so how many pairs of scissors? Two. You did pretty good on that. Now let me ask you another question. How many of them had a paint roller on it? One? Actually, all three of them have paint rollers. Moreover, they're all in more or less the same place. And this illustrates a design principle called inattentional blindness. There's a famous video some of you have probably seen with two teams playing basketball that illustrates inattentional blindness. If you haven't seen it, I have a YouTube channel called Billy Hollis UX. If you go there and look at my channel, there's a link to that video there. And you take a test that uses the inattentional blindness principle. The basic idea in inattentional blindness is this. The way your eye is wired, there is a small area that gives you high resolution. It's about the size of a quarter held at arm's length, or about the size of the full moon in the sky overhead at night. That's all of the high resolution your eye is able to render. Your visual processing system in your brain fills in the rest with a convincing fake. You don't really see it. So what you do is shoot the high resolution area around looking for the thing that you're trying to find or focus on right now. And your visual system just screens the rest right out. It's just a blur, really. Even though, I guess for your own psychological well-being, your brain pretends that you're actually seeing out there. But you're not, really. That's the principle of inattentional blindness. What does that mean? Well, for example, that means we don't need to be putting error messages in status bars at the bottom of the screen. That's stupid. People aren't going to see it because that's not where they're looking. We put the error messages where people will see them, unless we want to flash them or change colors, which will irritate the heck out of them. Okay? So inattentional blindness tells us certain things about how to do UI. So the first step, then, is to learn some of these principles. And as I mentioned, there are quite a few of them. I teach a three-day course on design principles. And in fact, I have a Pluralsight. How many of you have Pluralsight subscriptions? I have a new course up on Pluralsight. You can go watch me blabber about design principles for 4.5 hours. Or you buy me, and I'll come and blabber to you for 3 days about it. Actually, I do cover some other things in those 3 days. So that's design principles. And then once you understand them, and I've got some resources at the end that I'll help you understand them a bit. Next step after that is to expose yourself to good and bad design in the real world. You want to be looking for good and bad design. If you learn to recognize it in the real world, you will learn to recognize it in the software that you produce and that your team produces. So if you were here last year, you're going to remember this next test. I took this picture, Tech Ed, a couple of years ago. It's an elevator panel. And I want those of you who've already had the test, you have to be quiet, okay? It's about 10% of you. The other 90% have never seen this. Here's your test. When you look at this panel, I want you to decide, if you were getting on the elevator with somebody, find something about the elevator panel that you might comment to your companion when you saw it. Oh, well, look, that blah, blah, blah. Okay, so I want you to look at the panel until you see something you might comment on to another person. You ready? Okay, I'm going to show it as long as need be. Raise your hand when you find something. I'm going to keep it up until, maybe 2/3 of you have raised a hand. So when you put your hand up, please keep it up. Okay, we're up to about 25%, 30%. Some of you have paralyzed arms. Okay, getting around half now. Oh, we're getting good. Almost there. A few more. Okay, that's good. You're getting tired of holding your arms up, I think. Okay, what did you see? Who wants to tell me what they saw? I'm sorry? Hang on for that. There's some mass bad alignment down there. There's no 13th floor. Now that turns out, in my experience, to be the thing that developers tend to notice the most. There's no 13th floor. And certainly that's true. I mean, it's obvious. It's fairly common, actually, in hotels and cities that have casinos, because people don't want to stay on the 13th floor. But that is the sort of analytical thing that you will typically see a programmer recognize. But some of the other people pointed out some of the other stuff, that the alignment down there is whacked. But yeah, there's no one, but it's a ground floor. The problem is you can't tell that it's the ground floor, and that's what made me go back to my room and get a camera and take the picture, this right here. The paint is smeared off on the G. Why? Because people are pushing it. Why are they pushing it? It's not a button. It looks like a button. If you look at your shirt, if it has buttons, they're almost certainly round. In the world as a whole, we have what are called archetypes, universal forms that we expect things to have. People get on, especially in elevators. Elevator buttons are most commonly round. So you get on there, and remember the resolution problem. You're just kind of glancing. Your brain's filling it in. Your brain leaps to the conclusion that it's a button. You press it and sprain your finger because it doesn't move. When you become trained in design principles and thinking about things from a user experience design perspective, you spot things like that because they are unambiguous signals that a design is bad. And that tells you to go looking for why it's bad. This thing is just a train wreck of bad design, this panel is. Think about, for example, since the black placards with the numbers, since that's not the elevator buttons and the white things are, think about this. Do you notice that look between 4 and 5. Do you notice that the button is equidistant between 4 and 5? That violates the Gestalt principle of proximity. There's no way for the person to obviously group which one it goes with. Now, you can scan the entire line and kind of figure it out. But suppose you're a blind person who just discovered the 4 placard. Now there's 2 buttons on each side equidistant from it. That's bad design. And it doesn't have to be that way. Because this is the elevator in the Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas, Nevada. The only elevator I've ever been in with an advertisement for a tattoo parlor in the lobby. Oop, did I get over there? No, there it is. And notice that this does a much, much better job. Because the placards are no longer shaped, they're no longer round, which clearly differentiates them from the button. They have an indent, so the button can be snuggled right there inside the placard, respecting the Gestalt principle of proximity. A blind person would have no trouble locating the right floor. And there are other design principles that are respected here. The buttons used most often, or at least the buttons where they want you to go spend the most money, are bigger than the other buttons. There is no law that says all buttons have to be the same size. As dumb as our Congress is, they've never made a law like that. So, we can make our buttons any size we want. Important things ought to be bigger. So we need to watch for that in the real world. Another great thing to look at are remote controls. I find that remote controls are just a treasure trove of understanding design principles like Gestalt principles. Notice both mapping and Gestalt are respected here, up and down. The shapes tell you that what the grouping is like. Same thing down there. In fact, that one on the right there is a pretty good example to look at some of the different kinds of grouping that's possible. So if you look at these things and understand what makes them good, if you've got a remote control that gets on your nerves, analyze it and figure out what's wrong with it. Why does it irritate you? Why does it lead you to make mistakes? You see, if you go back to this elevator here, people are making the same mistake 100 times a day, and it's not their fault. It's the fault of the person who designed the elevator panel. If people are making mistakes in your software, it's not their fault either. It's your fault or the fault of whoever designed the software, whoever designed the user experience. Now, let's suppose then that you've figured out something about design principles. You've studied them for a while. And by the way, that's the sort of thing that will take you some time. You get better at it over time. The more you observe the real world, the more you understand how those principles have been applied, then the more you internalize them and the more that you are able to apply them to your own work. What's the next step after that? Well, the step after that in my mind is I want you to become unsatisfied with the way things are now. I want you to feel a visceral reaction when you see stuff like this. I do. This This screen makes me nauseous. Now, you don't have to go as far as me, okay? I'm a little bit whacked, but you should react with dissatisfaction when you see things done badly. Because I will tell you right now, in order to change things in a typical organization's IT department, there are enormous obstacles that you must deal with. All the habits, all the invisible cages that people are in, you may break out of yours. That doesn't mean they've broken out of theirs. And see, here's what I'm trying to do here. You're in your ruts or you're in your cage. And I'm trying to kick your butt out. Imagine that you're in the rut, you've got the walls of the rut, and you're just plodding along, and all you see is the walls of the rut. And I motivate you or kick you into climbing the walls, and there's this enormous, beautiful vista of things that you didn't even realize were there. Or if you're in the cage and the bars are gone and you walk and go through the hedges and now there's this big wide world out there you didn't know was there, that's fine. You see it. But if other people don't, then you're going to help them see it too. I work with companies on redesigning their user experience all the time. And I can tell you that the biggest single problem that I have is not coming up with new designs. Not at all. All I have to do is sit with the users for a few days and think about it and do some work for another few days, and I will come up with options. There are plenty of options out there because modern software sucks so badly. There are easy things you can do to make it better. The problem is not coming up with new designs. The problem is overcoming the inertia that's inherent in most development teams to fix and convert to those new designs. And understand that, particularly, you've got different kinds of users, and some of them are not your allies in this. There are many users that, if they're using a system like this that's badly designed, they don't care. They don't mind. Why? Because they've already figured out how to use it. It may have been painful for them to do, but now that is a sunk cost. They don't want to change. Because number one, what's the advantage? Number one, they figure if you change things, what are you going to do? You're going to break it. You're going to screw it up. That's their natural assumption. Unfortunately, based on their past experience, they have a reason to feel that way. Because we have never done a good job of understanding their needs and designing the way we should. So that's number one. Number two is, think about them in the context of their value to the corporation as they see it. The fact that they know how to use a clunky piece of software means they believe they're more valuable. If the barrier to entry for new users is high, if the training costs are extreme, well, gosh, that just makes them more valuable. It gives them leverage, doesn't it? What the users want is always to be respected and understood, but it does not always overlap with what the business wants. That's yet another design, a meta-design principle, is that you have to understand the differences in the different stakeholders and what they need and which one takes precedence. But I've had cases where, well, I went in to do this. Let's take a look at this is by far the most common thing I see. I see this in 2 out of 3 of the systems that I go in to analyze. Is that we see the system basically, it is architected very well. It uses the composite pattern so that we can plug in new modules on the fly, and we produce new modules every 2 or 3 weeks. And before you know it, what you've got is a menu system that has hundreds of options on it. See, the thinking that goes with that is you've made it possible. Somebody told you, we need to add a new module. We need to add a new function. You trotted it back to your cube or your office, and you worked on it for 2 weeks or 4 weeks or 8 weeks, and you got it done, and now what did you do? You just hung it off a menu somewhere, because as far as you're concerned, at that point, your job is over. But the problem is that this results in systems that are unnavigable by typical users, especially when they first walk in the door. Think about the emotional response here. You take one of these people whose entire experience. They're 20, in their 20s. They're coming into their first job. Their entire experience is with touch devices and smartphones. And then you sit them down in front of this. And this. What does that do for their emotional connection to your business? Does it increase the likelihood that they will love their job and stay loyal to you or not? That's some of the changes that we're dealing with. And my position is that if we don't learn how to do better, that we'll be replaced by people who do. And there are plenty of options to make it better. Look, just in this particular case, all the things we can do, we can add favorites so that people have their own menu options list, the 8 things that they do. They figure it out. We can have a most recently used menu item list so that the system automatically tracks what they have done most recently. We can have subsets of items based on roles. We can have a find capability to locate the item that they need to get to in that list of hundreds of things. Look, it just appalls me to see how seldom find capabilities are available. How many of you like the ribbon in Office? Well, I don't see a lot of hands. How many of you don't like it? Okay, now understand, number one, it's not made for you. And that's the reason you probably don't like it. It's made for people with a different way of looking at things who do simpler things than you do. And I don't like it much, but I would like it a lot better if it had a find option on it so that I didn't have to go clicking through these stupid tabs trying to find that thing I know is in there somewhere. Or we could have configurability. We could put all of the menu options in a giant list tree view thing. Let the user maybe see it with a drop down to say, yes, my role is X. I'd like to see these options. And then uncheck some and check others. Build their own custom menu. With still the ability to go back and get to something in the full menu that they use very, very infrequently. But you know what? Maybe what you really need is a completely different interaction or navigation pattern. If you analyze your application, maybe what it needs is a completely different way for the user to talk to it. There are dozens of these. Timelines and queues and viewports. And I don't have time to talk about them now because I have a whole session on that. Wednesday morning at 10:15, Dev 323, I'm going to talk about different patterns for modern user experience. So I'll drop that at this point and just point out that, yeah, there are quick fixes. I've seen some of these Windows Forms applications, and if you just gave me 3 days, I could make them a lot better. But if you really want to bring them into the modern world, then we would have to talk to the users, figure out what they really need, figure out what kind of navigation pattern is best, etc. Okay, well, what comes after that? The next step after that is, if you're convinced that things can be better, that there are better answers, then you have to prepare yourself to find them. And that means you have to force yourself to break out of that cage. You have to stop designing the applications the way you've always done it. I have a few exercises that will help you there. I've given you some of the elements. Looking at things in the real world, looking at good and bad design, analyzing software and deciding good and bad design. I would urge you to go back to your desk next week and look at Visual Studio and find all the things about it you think are well-designed and all the things you think need a better design. Visual Studio is over 20 years old. It's based on Visual Basic 1, was its ancestor back in the 90s. It's the same fundamental interaction pattern that we've had for 22 years. So in that period of time, a lot of things have changed. Microsoft has been reluctant to change it too much because you guys don't want it to change too much. Just like those users that already know how to use your clunky systems, well, now you're the user, and you don't want to change Visual Studio too much. I believe it's overdue for a change. Go back and look at it. Look at it through new eyes and see what you can find about it that's good and bad. Another exercise. This is a great exercise. To get by, one of the toughest things people have is this idea that we just divide the screen up into a bunch of rectangles and we put something in every rectangle. That's design in the minds of a lot of people in the industry now. Well, we can go beyond that. We don't have to just use rectangles. So take one of those crowded screens from your current application and print it out, and then redesign that screen from scratch on a blank sheet of paper with the following requirement. Your new design must include this curved shape. And I don't mean just as an icon on a button somewhere. I mean as in a non-trivial way that determines the feel of the screen overall. Now, will you end up with something better than what you have now? Probably not. There's a small chance that you will, but it will force you to think about the application in a completely different way, freed of the boundaries of the rectangle, the cage that you normally put yourself in. I have another little set of things that I think would be beneficial. There are several ways to use constraints. Let's talk about the second one there first, and then talk about the first one. One of the most beneficial ways to break out of your cage and do things differently is that, how many of you typically do a single prototype for the application that you're doing? You talk about the prototype, a prototype. For how many of you is that common? Come on, some of you are lying, I know, because I know the numbers are bigger than that. I go into these things. The problem with that is you are not exploring a design space. Think about it this way. You've got your prototype. It's like climbing a hill. You're trying to make it better. But that hill has a certain maximum height, and you'll never get above it. Maybe if you just looked over there, there's another hill that's even higher, and you could go climb that one and get even higher. But if you're concentrating on this hill, and by God, you're going to make sure this hill is completely explored, you'll never go look at that one. So what you do is, when you come up with one design, you put it aside and you pretend that you cannot use it. The lawyers don't like it, or the users hate it, or something. And then try to develop something. Put yourself in the mode of thinking, if I couldn't do it that way, what's another way to do it? And then put that one aside and do it again. We do this 3, 4, 5 times in our typical design cycle. We find that the most common design that ends up being the right one is number 2. 1 is almost always too traditional, doesn't really break any new ground, doesn't really think about the problem in as much depth as we would like. It's almost automatic. But when we say, let's not do it that way, then we usually come up on a better way. Then I've got a card deck. Let me explain to you how this works. What I do is I print out these cards. It's a Microsoft Word document. You can have it if you want it. That prints on index card stock. You've seen index card stock, right? 10 cards, and you tear them up, and you've got business cards, made for business cards. Well, instead, I'm printing my design stuff, my design cards. It's like Monopoly cards. Think of it as Monopoly cards for design. So in the document, you print it out, and you get cards that look like this, and the idea is that if you get stuck or you just want to kind of generate some new ideas, then draw a card and do whatever it tells you to do. Force yourself out of your rut. I particularly like the one in the bottom right down there. You've just acquired some users who are 6 years old. Modify your design to accommodate them. It is surprising to me how often things that would fit a 6-year-old will fit actually an entire user population. A lot of them act like 6-year-olds, don't they? Looks kind of busy. Remove half the labels. Well, that'll be a bit of a challenge for you. Increase white space 50%. Tilt something. And then the one in the middle of the last column is an invitation to you to put yourself in somebody else's head. All right? I'm inviting you to put yourself in my head and say, what would he not like about this? What would he be unsatisfied with? And what could I do to fix that and change it? So that's my invitation there. So if you want something that'll kick your pants a little bit, you can have my design card deck. Now, things that I want you to avoid, things I want you to not do, because it's when you're trying to break into new ground, there are some potholes. I mentioned the aesthetics thing, that you don't want to overemphasize aesthetics. Let me make it clear, I said this before, but just to emphasize, aesthetics are important for first impressions, but they don't carry the day on everything. But some of the folks that come from the graphic design world and the content design world tend to focus almost exclusively on those kinds of aesthetic elements. They don't really focus on the interaction design. And that's actually what you need to do and what's hard to do. In modern systems, HTML5 and XAML, styling and colors and typefaces, look, that can be done very late in the development process. And it's really easy to change if you decide that it's not what you want. So the cost for fixing it, if you decide you want something different, is very low. But interaction design is baked into the system, meaning that if you don't get it right, then your cost to fix it is much, much higher. So if somebody comes in as a designer and they want to talk a lot about typefaces, for example, well, all of our modern platforms have perfectly adequate typefaces for applications. If you're doing content, that matters more. We did the Windows Phone application for the New York Times newsreader. Okay, yeah, we're delivering content. Now it turns out that typography becomes much more important in what we're doing. But for normal business applications, default fonts on modern UI platforms are fine. So don't spend a lot of stress figuring that kind of stuff out. Worry about the interaction design. Let's talk about some of the resources I'd like you to do, and then I should have about 5 minutes or so to take questions. I'd like to talk mostly about books. This is the book I suggest most people start with when they get into this space. This describes design principles briefly and concisely, but in such a way that you won't have any trouble, I think, absorbing them, assimilating them. Don't try to read it all at once. It can be overwhelming after a while. Read 10 or 15 at a time. There are 125 design principles in this book. With examples. They all have examples of the principle being respected or being violated. This is a bestseller. It's been around for years. They updated it recently. So I suggest you start with this. This book, by the way, you know, you buy technology books. Do you guys throw them away as often as I do? Because their lifespan on my shelf is about 2 or 3 years. And then they're obsolete. Get them out of there. This book will still be good in 5 years or 10. You'll keep this one a long time. Then most of my Gestalt examples, some of the stuff about the visual system come from this book, Designing with the Mind in Mind. If you're interested in the science behind a lot of this stuff, you know, we're developers, we really care about stuff like that. If you're interested in the science, this is the book you probably want to get. If you're interested in going out into the real world and observing it and critiquing it and looking at design there, this is the original work that started a whole trend. It's called The Design of Everyday Things. I actually got the first edition back in 1987, which has a different title. The original title was The Psychology of Everyday Things, which tells you something about sort of the connection of psychology to user interface design. Donald Norman is considered a pioneer in this field. He has several books, but you should probably start with this one. We're doing pretty good on time, aren't we? Let me tell you one of the great stories out of this book. Maybe it'll motivate you to go do it. he was called in to evaluate some nuclear power plants. After Three Mile Island, people were worried. They were running some drills. Their error rates were too high. He went in, and what he saw was a panel that controlled valves. This is back in the 80s when we didn't have as much electronics. The valve control levers were steel rods with a round handle on them. And there were about 6 or 8 in a row, placed a couple inches apart. So what do you suppose the possibility is that under the stress of an emergency drill, somebody would grab the wrong one? Unfortunately, far higher than they should be. And as soon as he saw it, he said, look, there's no excuse for this. This problem was solved hundreds of years ago. And every one of you has seen the solution. You know where it is? Down in your neighborhood bar. Go look at the beer tap handles. There's a reason they're different shapes. A trained bartender will grab one. If they grab the wrong one, they will know that they grabbed the wrong one. If they grab Miller Lite instead of Miller, and they will immediately pull their hand back and get the right one. So he's got a picture then of the nuclear power plant with the rods, and now they all have different beer handles on them. So that tells you something. Think outside your normal cage. Get out there. One of the better things you can do, and I do this, and I'm only a minority of people will try it, but the number of emails I get from people who tell me that this was the most important to them is very high. I keep getting these emails from people. They say, I got this book, and I cannot believe 2 weeks later what I am able to do. I would never have believed that I could do this. So if you want to learn to draw, this is, for developer types, a pretty good way to do it. Drawing on the right side of the brain and the workbook that goes with it. Okay, here's some information if you want to get a hold of me. As I mentioned, I do classes in this stuff. I also do classes in XAML technologies, especially for teams that are transitioning to some XAML platform, and consulting on user interface design and construction. So we have, I think, about 4 minutes or so for questions. Are back there? Come to the microphone, please, if you have questions, so that it can get on the audio. So if you have a question, just find one of the other microphones. There's several of them around, okay. And I'll just kind of go around the mics.
One of the biggest problems I would see in implementing some of these changes is breaking the look and feel of the application. So it's all boxy, and that's what all the screens look like, and then you come in with one with a much better design, flying shapes and things like that. How do you go about selling that as, you know, being so inconsistent inside of the same application?
The consistency issue is certainly a big one in that, especially if you have to keep part of the old application and part of the new. Surprisingly enough, the answer to that for me has been to the further I go, the more bold I get in trying to do a new design, the further I get away from what it was before and the more it matches what they're going to do, the less that is a problem. When I show something to somebody that really encapsulates their workflow, they lose the concern about consistency. Because you're right, if people are focused on the consistency, then they think that, gosh, I mean, they've been told it's supposed to be consistent. So that's part of the inertia. And you would think that maybe if you just kind of gradually migrate and don't get too inconsistent, that that would be the better path. That, in my experience, always fails. I have not seen an exception to that. You have to go to the next generation. And if you get it right, they will stop asking you about the consistency issues. They will put up with the inconsistency in the time it takes to move everybody to the other platform. Right there.
Following on from that question, do you have any advice on how to change the culture in an organization to get them into a more design-centric point of view?
How do you change the culture in an organization to become more design-centric? That's really hard, and you have to get somebody pretty far up the executive chain to do it. The idea that the developers can all of a sudden decide that they want to be more design-centric and push that up, no, you really have to go up a couple of levels and convince somebody. Fortunately, that turns out not to be quite as hard as you might think. It's very, very common for executives to come in and plop an iPad in the IT department and say, we need to do it. That's your entry point. You go, yes, we can figure out how to make software run on these mobile devices, but you must understand our culture isn't ready for that, and we need to change. So when they're ready, that's your entry point typically to do it. Let me tell you, those guys love their iPads. I was in a meeting with executives and heard one talk about an iPad and say she has an emotional relationship with her iPad. All right, so, and I mean, people probably have an emotional relationship with your software too, but it's not a positive one. We're talking about a good one. So, yeah, that's typically the entry point, is when they realize that it's time to go to the next generation, then you explain to them this is what's required to do it. It isn't just a matter of we put a new skin on the app or anything like that. We have to completely rethink it, and we need a different culture to do that. And they'll probably then say, well, why don't you go out and hire a designer? And you have to explain to them why that doesn't work then. We've got time for maybe one more. Any more? Anybody else at a mic? Yeah.
I understand that doing an intuitive design is great for the new user, but for the more experienced user, it may not be just as important. So do you find that perhaps there is a contradiction between making a very intuitive design and making a very efficient design for experience?
The intuitive versus efficiency. Well, certainly if you have people, call center operators would be a typical example, where efficiency is very important, then you need to build in all the things that make them efficient, the keystrokes and the things like that. Whereas my app was written for salespeople, and they need a completely different experience. That just changes the nature of the design that you're doing. It doesn't mean that you don't build in the intuitive things. It just means you also build in the ability for them to do it quickly. And then you give them ways to discover that quick stuff. We're seeing a lot of gamification of applications, for example, that it looks really nice and intuitive to start with, but it requires a lot of mousing around, but that there's some kind of achievement where you go, I accomplished the same thing with a bunch of keystrokes, and they learn to do it that way. So, yeah, when you've got a group of users like that, now we very often do multiple modes of interaction, that we will change out the mode of interaction depending upon whether it's that kind of user or the user that just kind of walks up to it a few times a day. You can't satisfy both. But in a modern, well-architected system, it's surprisingly easy to put a new experience on top of it if you've architected the client tier correctly. Okay, I hope this has been beneficial. I hope to see some of you on Wednesday.